Hi folks, welcome to episode 99 of the Epochs of the Lotus Eaters. I'm joined by Beau, and today we're going to be talking about the Sumerians, which is a very interesting and oblique subject to talk about, considering what we've previously been discussing.
Carrying on with the very first stuff, first civilizations and peoples. The Sumerians, first thing to say is how far back it is. Mm. I mean, it's really the first, I mean, it's disputed a bit exactly what was the first civilization and what constitutes a civilization and all that sort of thing, especially in the 19th century. Mm. People love to talk about that and argue about that. But if you're going to call it a technological and stratified civilization, in other words, they're using tools in a fairly sophisticated way, not just to like open shellfish, but actually to sort of do irrigation and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And stratified, i.e. they've got their society has got tiers and layers to it.
Yeah, they've got a division of labour. They've got kings, they've got priests, they've got aristocrats, they've got peasants, they've got slaves.
Yeah, exactly. So it's decided at some point that that is sort of the criterion to say it's a full sort of civilization in the modern sense, in the same way we live today.
Yeah.
In all sorts of ways. Now, some people have said that it's possible that the very, very first examples of that might have been in the Indus Valley. Mm-hmm. But it seems, most agree, that it's in southern Mesopotamia, modern southern Iraq, which was the Sumerian peoples. Mm-hmm. So, you know, woolly mammoths were still roaming the earth at that point.
Yeah, they were, yeah.
We're talking like 5,000 plus BC.
Yeah.
So, you know, 7,000 years before present. So it's crazily old. You know, it's before the Bronze Age collapse, before the Hittites, before the Assyrians, before the Babylonians, all of that, before Stonehenge,
in fact,
before the pyramids.
They all owe a great debt of legacy from the Sumerians. They'll take so much from the Sumerians.
Assyrians and Babylonians are sort of an echo of the Sumerians and the Akkadians.
Yeah, in the same way that Latin pervades much of Europe, the Sumerians pervaded Babylonian Assyrian culture.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Even by the time of sort of the Hittites and the Assyrians and things, the Sumerian civilization was long gone and almost forgotten in some ways.
Yeah.
That's how old it is. In fact, by the time the Sumerian civilization completely collapses, there were still woolly mammoths on the earth.
On Wrangel Island.
They came and gone. Exactly. So they came and went. Yeah. That's how old it is. So it really is the first stuff. They called themselves the black-headed people.
I always found that an interesting designation because why that? Why the colour of the... Because when they say black-headed, they mean black-haired.
Right, exactly, yeah.
It's not to do with skin colour or anything like that. It's to do with the fact they have black hair. But they probably had, you know, sort of like a dark olive, sort of Middle Eastern skin tone, right? So why was that the thing, you know? Because, I mean, surely lots of people in the Middle East have dark hair.
Yeah, we don't know. Yeah. Lots of times, probably in this epoch, I'm going to say, we don't know.
Yeah, I know we don't know. this is something I find particularly fascinating, actually, because as I'm sure we're going to bring up, they've got an isolated language. Their language isn't related to any of the other languages in the area, which are mostly like Semitic or Persian or Iranian, so Indo-Steppe, you know, whatever it is. And so the Sumerians are totally alien. And so it's like, okay, where have they come from? And so there's a part of me that wonders if they weren't, I don't know, from like the Orient or something, you know, like, because they've got a completely original language. And they've got black hair. It's like, okay, but who actually has black hair? And the only place I can think of is places like China.
Well, places like the subcontinent, places like India, places like the Indus Valley, which is sort of modern-day Pakistan.
Yeah. Do they have black hair there?
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm not sure I'd call it black. I'd have thought brown. But, I mean, yeah, maybe I'm quibbling over.
Yeah, so where the Sumerians came from, that is interesting because, as you say, their language is a language isolate. Mm. It's got no connection whatsoever with Semitic languages, which is all the other languages in what we call
region.
The modern Middle East. Yeah, in the whole region. It's completely separate. In fact, quick side note, when modern scholars and archaeologists first came across cuneiform, or cuneiform, however you say that, they thought it was just, they thought it might be a code. Or they thought it was, they didn't think it was a language.
They didn't think it was a form of writing. No, this is how an entire civilization communicated for thousands of years.
Yeah. Yeah.
So for anyone wondering, cuneiform, what they would do is cut the end of a reed, so it produced a kind of wedge shape, and then they would press the wedge into clay in certain patterns to create their writing. And it's actually really fortunate for people who like history, because when you burn down a city full of clay tablets, what you do is you bake them, and then they're like that forever.
Mm. Yeah. So as we've said in other epochs, quite often our view of the past, the ancient world, is only really, there's only ever really much detail to it, any real colour, when you come across civilizations that wrote things down, that survive.
Yeah. Yeah.
So for example, the Scythians did and the Greeks did.
Yeah.
So all we know is what survived of Greek writing about themselves and about the Scythians, right? It just so happens that that we know quite a lot, relatively, about the Sumerians because of exactly that.
Yeah.
Loads of cuneiform tablets survived. Loads. I mean, hundreds of thousands.
Yeah.
It's mad how many.
And that, and there are hundreds of thousands from the Assyrians and Babylonians as well. And most of them are really, really boring.
Mm.
Yeah. Most of them are lists of goods or receipts.
Right.
Or, you know, just stock and cargo. It's insane that the genesis of writing was for trade purpose.
For bureaucracy and things, right, yeah. To keep tally of who owns what sort of thing. Owes what.
It literally took them about 2,000 or 3,000 years to write down the epics. So really, like, we've had writing, or at least something that approximates to writing, for literally like 2,000 years. And only now we're going to write down, like, the Bible of Sumerian culture. It's crazy when you think about it.
It's interesting. Imagine if you took all the paperwork from, say, the 1960s.
Hmm.
Only a tiny volume of that would be interesting, right?
Yeah.
Nearly all of it would be really, really boring.
Yeah.
Paper, like, bureaucratic nonsense that you don't care about.
Yeah.
That has no bearing. And that's what we have in the cuneiform record.
Yeah.
In some of the big museums, there's just storerooms full of Sumerian cuneiform tablets that no one's translated yet.
Yeah, because there's probably no point.
And there's very few people that can read cuneiform. Yeah. And over the millennia, it changes as well. So it's not the same.
But also, there are multiple languages that are written in cuneiform. So you could have, Akkadian, Assyrian, Babylonian, or Sumerian, and they're different languages using the same writing style.
Mm.
So knowing someone who can pass cuneiform symbols and then also understands the Sumerian language. About 15 years ago, I actually was interested in learning Sumerian language, and it was fun. I learned how to say I love you in Sumerian. I can't remember how it is now, though. But the thing is, it's just so alien that it's not like learning French. You know, French is alien enough, whereas Sumerian is just... You know, this, you have to be raised with it to be really good at it, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Or a really dedicated person. I was just doing it for fun. So
it's like a language isolate. So it's just got no.
And it's been dead for thousands of years.
So there are more or less difficult languages, aren't there? I've heard that Finnish is quite difficult. Hungarian is quite difficult.
Yeah.
If you're raised in the West, in the Western tradition, something like Japanese or Korean is very difficult.
Yeah.
You know, for an Englishman to learn French or Spanish or German.
Or Dutch.
You know. Right, yeah, it's sort of, you're already halfway there almost.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're to learn Korean, you've got to start from day one, from scratch entirely. Anyway, and so cuneiform, the earliest cuneiform was pictographs, literally little pictures, and it gets more and more sophisticated until it's, as you say, just these reed symbols, and it's, they started their own type of alphabet with hundreds of characters.
Yeah, it's got a kind of, it's got its own kind of grammar to it. So
yeah,
the way that you'd have a symbol that meant something, and then you prefix and suffix it with other symbols that had meaning as well. So often there's a symbol called dingir, which is essentially just the reeds overlaid on each other to make a star, and that's the symbol for divinity. And so that symbol always prefixes the name of a god.
Right.
And so that's how you know they're talking about a god. And that's how I did a little bit of studying on it, because it was fun. And that's one of the things that I remember about it.
I suppose like in Egyptian, a cartouche, if you put a cartouche around a name or around something, you realise that's a name.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. All sorts of things like that. Yeah. And to be a scholar in cuneiform, there's not that many of them in the whole world.
Yeah. It must be only a handful.
Yeah. You need to be among the very best linguists in the whole world to sort of start on it almost.
Yeah.
Nonetheless, the more famous things like the Epic of Gilgamesh and some of the more famous pieces of cuneiform that have survived to us are amazing. They tell us all sorts of insights into daily life, all sorts of things we've got, like their board games.
Yeah.
And their music. They wrote down their music, so we know what type, how we found archaeological evidence of like a lyre, a Sumerian lyre, and writing about what the songs were and how they're to be played and all that sort of thing.
There's,
incredible, really.
There's a video on YouTube of a guy who constructed one and learned how to play it. Oh, and I should have dug it up for this, actually.
I haven't seen that. It sounds brilliant.
I will send it across to you. We'll see if we can cut it in or something.
Right.
It's really good.
Yeah.
It's how did I feel about it? It was kind of... There was something remote about it, right? It was something from... It felt like it was something out of deep time, you know? And there was something being... Because when... And a quick side note on music itself, just the music... I always wondered what the purpose of music was. And it's surely got to be about the expression of emotions. And I do feel that this music is trying to speak to something that is just long lost and I don't understand. Like maybe it's just the poor modern interpretation or something, but to me it came across as very soulful.
Wistful.
Yeah, and there was something about it that made you feel like you're a small thing in a much bigger universe, right? Because one of the things I think about in the modern day is how big we feel ourselves to be. Whereas this feels like the opposite, you know, and like these people are in a very complex, changing universe of things that happen that are very serious every day, and they don't have a full understanding of them. So it becomes humbling, I found.
Yeah. I mean, if Gilgamesh is anything to go by, they seem to have had quite a deep sense of, like, sorrow and wistfulness. Yeah, yeah. And there's writings that survive from the end of the Sumerian culture and civilization, where their cities are being sacked and burnt to the ground by sort of Elamites and things.
Yeah.
Where laments, whole poems that are just laments about the loss of everything.
The one that springs to mind is the Lament of Ur.
Right, that's the
famous one. one of the oldest cities on Earth, possibly the oldest city on Earth. And you can tell by the sort of phonetic sound of it. What's the word? It's Ur. You know, that Ur. Yeah, exactly. It's the most guttural, basic sound. And that's the name of the very first city, basically. And that's how primitive this civilization, the origin point of like human civilization is in these really basic sounds.
I will call it but I think I've heard people say that something like that. Who knows?
I, as an English speaker, just call it
The question of where the Sumerians came from, sometimes it's called the Sumerian problem, because they seem to have sort of, we're just not sure exactly where they came from. It does seem from their language and from other bits and bobs, scraps of information, that they probably weren't completely indigenous to southern Iraq, Mesopotamia. So some say maybe they came from the sort of the Indus Valley and came along in boats along like the southern coast of Iran, along there, and came up sort of the Persian Gulf. But one thing to say, this is so long ago that the map itself is different. So nowadays, where Ur is you've got the Tigris and Euphrates. I'll put up maps so everyone can see what we're talking about. It's not really anywhere near the coast.
Yeah.
But back then it was on the coast. Ur was a coastal trading port. And now it's in the middle of the desert.
Yeah, because what happens is down the Tigris and Euphrates, massive amounts of silt are brought and they get deposited at the end. And so over the millennia, it grows out into the sea.
Exactly. Exactly that.
And also, like, another thing as well, the Tigris and Euphrates have changed courses very, very, you know, not massively, obviously, but like, you know, the cities that were on the banks of the river are no longer on the banks of the river and vice versa. So it's like, right, okay. It's very interesting how these things change. And I always wonder what, like, I mean, I agree that the Sumerians probably didn't begin there. They must have come from somewhere else, because otherwise they'd look something like the other people of the region, you know, who have always kind of been there. So I wonder what it is that they must have found, because there couldn't, you know, must have been just some, because the problem with Iraq, terrain-wise, is there's no, is there any particular reason that a nomadic tribe would stay there?
Well, only the water.
Exactly.
Well, the land between the rivers, yeah. Mesopotamia, that's fertile.
But if you're not agricultural,
right?
Which presumably prior to the Sumerians arriving there, they weren't. Then why would you even be there? So it's probably like essentially a desolate land with, you know, maybe, you know, gazelles or something. But like, you know, you want forest and.
Well, so it seems that the sort of early people or even proto people, Homo erectus and all that sort of thing, they've been in and around that region for 500,000 years.
Sure.
But yeah, why they developed into sort of the first sophisticated cultures and civilizations.
So what I mean is like the population density then must have always been fairly low.
Oh, it was, yeah.
You know, like very low, really. And so it's the Sumerians, with the advent of agriculture and cities, that first actually make the region something notable.
Yeah. Well, there's one thing that was mentioned in a very, very early, or Josephus in the first century AD tells us of an ancient Sumerian story about their own origins.
Oh, yeah.
And people, you know, modern scholars say, you know, take it with a massive pinch of salt.
Obviously.
But they themselves talked about a type of god or a half fish man called Owanis, who was sort of the founder of the Sumerians and the Sumerian culture and civilization. And a cuneiform tablet says that this Owanis, this sort of mythical half fish man, semi-deity creature, sort of came out of the sea and gave the Sumerians all the secrets of culture and civilization. It's supposed to have said, he brought them knowledge of letters, sciences, and all kinds of techniques. He also taught them how to found cities, build temples, create laws, and measure plots of land. He revealed to them how to work the land and gather fruits, and then disappeared back into the sea.
So I'm going to go out on a limb and suggest that indicates the Sumerians sailed to the to Mesopotamia,
right?
Rather than actually a fish god,
right?
Came out of the sea. You know, they arrived on boats, right? So that's what I'm going to interpret that as being an ancient memory of.
Yeah, quite well. Yeah, yeah. You would have thought so. Yeah. That's the most likely logical thing, isn't it? Now we're going so far back in time that maybe it would take into account the Great Flood, the Great Biblical Flood,
which of course they have a legend of themselves.
Nearly all ancient cultures and civilizations talk of great inundations.
Yeah.
Whether it's the exact same great flood with Noah and the Bible, we don't know. But, you know, people like Graham Hancock and others talk about at the end of the Ice Age, a great thaw.
Yeah.
And that there were, the sea levels rose. And we know that is an actual fact. We know that's definitely the case.
Yeah, I don't see any problem with interpreting the... Well, isn't it called the Younger Dryas period, the end of the Dryas?
That's right.
And so there is going to have been a massive release of water into the world's oceans. Doubtless this caused flooding everywhere.
Yeah.
There's no, you know, I've got no doubt about it. And I don't see any problem with the cultural memory of tribal cultures and, you know, pre-civilized cultures, remembering that at some point, one of their ancestors was literally looking out and all he could see is water because of this massive flood. Mm. So, right, okay, the gods have flooded the earth. Oh, my God, we're such terrible people, whatever it is. You know, and that's been passed down in loads of different cultures. So cause there's no reason to think it wouldn't have happened all over the world. And I think it's totally reasonable. It's not in any way a leap of logic or something unlikely. And I think that this is one of those things we can point to and say this is probably a memory of an event that really happened.
Yeah. So quickly on that, in the sort of 18th and 19th and early 20th century or most of the 20th century still, in archaeological circles, it was just thought gauche. It was just thought a faux pas to think the Great Flood is a real event.
Yeah.
But it seems now that it just certainly was. It seems a matter of record that 10,000, 11,000 years before present, there was the Younger Dryas event and whatever that is. There's a question for another time.
Yeah.
But from then, over the next few thousand years, so it wasn't a quick thing, but over 3,000 years, the sea level rose something like 120 metres, which is about 30 stories.
Yeah.
That's gigantic. So in other words, before that event started, the coastlines of the whole world, the entire map of the whole world would have been very, very, very different. Well, 120
wildly metres lower.
And yeah.
I mean, think Doggerland and places like that. They were just totally exposed and had, you know, thousands of people living on there hunting mammoths.
Most people live on coastlines.
Yeah. And, so, you know, you've got like this massive area, probably loads of rivers there, lots of people like hunting mammoths. There's all of this, like tribal civilization, I suppose we'll call it. Like, you know, the tribal knowledge of the area, and then suddenly the sea levels rise 100 meters, and so now that's 100 meters underwater, which doesn't sound like a lot, but actually,
it's
100 meters. You know, like
they say, 30 odd stories. That's a giant. That's a skyscraper. 30 stories. Yeah, sorry, 120 odd meters. 30 stories.
Yeah.
That's massive.
It is, and. You know, remember that you're not even 2 meters tall, you know, so it, like it's a really, really catastrophic event. And like I said, I can completely believe that there was some just tribesman sitting on a rock where everything he could see was just, as far as the eye could see, where he once walked was just water. And he's just like, right, that's a problem.
So you mentioned Doggerland. So Britain wasn't an island.
No.
All of the channel and a lot of the sea between us and Scandinavia was land. There was a land bridge between Siberia and Alaska. There was no Bering Straits. Loads of sort of Southeast Asia, where Malaysia is, loads of that was just all land. It wasn't sort of broken, fractured archipelagos and islands. It was just one massive landmass. So the world was very different. And where we have today, where the Tigris and Euphrates flood out into the Persian Gulf, that would have been all land, or mostly, depending exactly when you're talking about.
Yeah.
So it could well have been that the Sumerians maybe sort of originally came from further east, or from the Indus Valley area, or were just sort of indigenous to that land, which is now 120 metres under the sea. Over millennia, or certainly centuries, the sea encroaches, and they're pushed further and further north, further and further and further north, until they come into contact with people that sort of are more or less indigenous to central and northern Iraq, modern central northern Iraq, or the upper reaches of Mesopotamia. And they come into contact with each other, the Akkadian people and the Sumerian people. And it seems that the Sumerians were just from the get-go more sophisticated in all sorts of ways. The manufactures they made, their ability to dig canals and have irrigation and all sorts of things like that. It seems they were the more sophisticated out of the Akkadians and the Sumerians.
Absolutely. The Akkadians definitely essentially inherited their civilization from the Sumerians. Like, and the thing that's sophisticated about the Sumerians is just the level of organization that's remarkable. Like they actually have a way of moving thousands of men, which doesn't sound very impressive to us now, but then it really was. I mean, like the army of Sargon of Akkad, so like, you know, 1,000 years after this, was meant to be 5,000 men, which is massive. It's absolutely enormous. When the, you know, like Ur and Uruk and all that, they have about possibly 20 to 30,000 people, which is a colossal city.
Yeah.
You know, these are numbers that have not been seen before.
Yeah. I mean, not even that to begin with, the Sumerians like Ur or Uruk may had like 10,000.
Yeah, yeah.
And that is the biggest city the world had ever seen by far.
Yeah.
And it's 10,000.
Yeah. So. Yeah, yeah, exactly. You know, and but that's what I mean. Like, so, like, you know, 2,000, 3,000, or 1,000 or 2,000 years later, when you've got Sargon of Akkad, that it's still only 30,000. Mm-hmm. And he has an army of 5,000, allegedly. You know, but it's like you can see. It's the organisational capability of this civilization that's the key thing.
So just to say a quick last word on the Great Flood. It may well have been that the Sumerians, deep in antiquity, experienced it. Mm-hmm. They passed that down to sort of their successor cultures, like the Assyrians and the Babylonians. The Jewish people got it from Babylon, and it ends up in the Bible.
Yeah.
So it may well be as simple as that. It's not simple at all, is it? But it may just be that.
It's a plausible lineage.
Right.
There are other cultures, though, that aren't connected. Like the Mayans have some sort of flood myth.
It would have been all over the world.
Exactly. So there's no reason to think that it has to have a lineage. But I do think that what you've laid out there is a totally plausible lineage. I mean, I think that the Hebrews got a lot from the Babylonian exile.
Yeah. Seems they got a lot of it from Babylon.
Mm.
Yeah, for sure. So the world, certainly by the 6th millennia BC, the sort of the Sumerian world, and the first cities start cropping up, their world would have, I'll put it on the map, would have been on the coast.
Yeah.
And as you said, the Tigris and Euphrates have changed their courses quite a lot. So Uruk would have been on the river, and it's not now, remnants of it. It's just in the middle of the desert again, but their world would have been sort of to their east. The Zagros Mountains of Iran would have penned them in, where there's sort of completely uncivilized, barbarous men there that penned them in. To the north, the far north, sort of the Taurus Mountains of sort of Armenia, Turkey, again with barbarous half savages there. Full savages.
These areas are a nightmare for the entire Sumerian period of Sumerian civilization, because at some point just tens of thousands of savages just come down to loot and plunder and rape.
Yeah, like the Guti. I'll get to that in the next epochs. And to their west and south, there's just the endless Arabian desert.
Mm.
So, and their world, if you like, is Mesopotamia, the land between the rivers, the Tigris and Euphrates, and the floodplains, the quite fertile, well, very fertile floodplains. That was sort of their world.
Mm.
And Ur is among the first cities, but they think the very first one, which is very close to Ur, was Eridu, a place called Eridu. And it looks like the earliest archaeology is probably something like 5,400 odd BC.
Mm. So that's remarkable.
It really 7,000
years ago, more than
And they're building, it's like a it's small, but it's a city, really. Mm.
Doesn't Eridu become some sort of sacred site as well? It's a holy city. I mean, all the cities were holy, but like...
The Sumerians called it like our first city, the first city. Yeah. It's where men came from in a way, senses.
Yeah.
It's where all our culture, all our city building tradition all started in Eridu. That's what they say.
Mm.
And the archaeology does seem to back that up. Seems to be the oldest stuff is there.
Mm.
I mean, pardon me. There are older things, like, so for example, Göbekli Tepe.
Yeah.
And there are other places.
Jericho as well.
All places, in the Levant, in places like Israel and Jordan and Syria and Turkey. There are examples of older settlements.
But these are all much more primitive
than
Sumerian settlements. Right. That's the thing. Like, I remember looking into the archaeology of Jericho, which is genuinely fascinating. And it might have actually had walls, like 9,000 BC or something like that, like unbelievably early. But it was just a collection of huts that was surrounded by a wall. Mm. You know, there wasn't a division of labor. There wasn't specialized buildings. There was, I guess you could call it hierarchies, in that the person they assume was the chieftain had a slightly larger hut than other people. But like, it's not what we would call a civilization.
Right, yeah. Yeah, there were like some grain silos a bit later on. And whereas archaeologists and modern historians look back at Eridu and then later Ur and Uruk and places like that and say, no, here we can see, you can point to sort of fairly clearly that it's got a sort of a clearly stratified structure hierarchy going on.
Yeah.
And it's, although small, it's a city in the modern sense.
Mm.
And it suggests, or it proves really, that they would have had all sorts of modern things going on, like the division of labour and irrigation and things. Yeah. So they realised when the first peoples started or stopped being nomadic sort of hunter-gatherers, that where you throw away seeds in your midden pits, in your trash piles, they noticed that the things grew there, plants grew there.
Mm.
So they obviously made the jump, why don't we deliberately cultivate that and deliberately plant things? Yeah. We can do that along the silty river banks.
Mm-hmm.
And then you realise, if we build channels, we can do more of that more inland, away from it being areas that might get completely inundated and flooded at any given time. And so that's irrigation.
And maintenance of irrigated fields is labour intensive. You know, you have to, you know, you You have to spend the time to make sure that these are cleared out and do whatever you need to do to them. And this is something that is remarked upon in periods of famine and catastrophe, where they say that the irrigation is filled up, or things like and things like this. So it's like it's been left to fall into rack and ruin. Yeah. And they knew that there was an obligation they had to do. You know, they were very aware of these things.
Later in the decline and fall of Akkad and Sumeria, which we'll talk about in the next one, a byword for just destruction and desolation is that your irrigation canals have been left to silt up.
Yeah.
That the grass is growing across the roads.
Yeah.
And that your irrigation is screwed. Yeah, that's what that is. So at first, there were sort of date palms. They'd plant and grow date palms. Mm-hmm. And then under the shade of that, because obviously the Iraqi sun is blazingly hot. Yeah, I mean, sort of 40, 50 degrees. It gets up there among the hottest places on earth. And in the shade of date palms, they grew all sorts of things. Wheat, millet, sesame, pomegranates, grapes, figs, chickpeas, lentils, leeks, garlic, cucumbers, all sorts of things, cress.
Yep.
And in fact, not too long into the Sumerian culture, we've got like recipes with like a dozen different ingredients.
Yeah.
So in certain places, like Ur was known as nearly always having an abundance of food, an abundance of diverse ingredients.
Why wouldn't it? I remember seeing a Sumerian recipe book online.
Really?
I should have got it. I'll look for it actually. Maybe we'll make something. But, I mean, it's nothing that isn't modern though, is it? You know,
right? Yeah.
You'd seal this. They put salt in it, you know, to taste. They have probably other spices as well. Like, there's nothing. Like, human food hasn't actually changed that much, really, has it?
It also seems that from quite early on, especially Ur, which was, again, on the coastline, they were still somehow trading with places like modern-day Oman and the Indus Valley, where you may well get odd spices and things.
Yeah. There's a bunch of trade routes that spring up really early, actually. And these... What's interesting is the Sumerians have got a very compact view of the world, and so places like Dilmun, which are probably in Arabia, far down the Arabian coast, sorry, where sort of UAE is and stuff like that.
Dubai, they
would trade with them for various things, you know, spices from Arabia and stuff. And so these places take on a kind of mythical significance, which is nice. You know, it's adorable, the worldview. I find it really enchanting. And then you've got like the cedars of Lebanon, because of course one thing that Iraq doesn't have is forests. And, you know, you're surrounded by basically bare mountains that are baking hot. Mm. You've got to go right the way across the Fertile Crescent to get to Lebanon to find wooded mountains. And so the cedars of Lebanon, as we'll come on to with Gilgamesh, I'm sure, in a minute, take on, again, another mythic significance. You know, these are deeply important things because good wood is very hard to find.
And so unbelievably useful in a multitude of different ways.
Just as a quick thing, in Europe, we don't understand how lucky we are for building materials, actually. Mm. You know, we've got forests everywhere.
And all sorts of natural resources.
Yeah.
So Mesopotamia, particularly southern Mesopotamia, southern Iraq, it's very, very resource poor.
Yeah.
You've got nice, silty, fertile soil, and not much else. Like, there's not really much workable stone, even. There's hardly any wood whatsoever.
There's a reason that the existing buildings are still made of clay.
Yeah.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.